All right, so we have one matter on calendar today. EIOR versus Alokum Lotto. As I indicated to counsel before argument, the day sheet says 20 minutes per side. I'm going to be a little bit liberal in terms of time today, but the advice is don't rush, but don't ramble. And with that, counsel, why don't you go ahead and state your appearance?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Alexander Halaska from the Department of Justice for the government. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
You may.
Controlling the flow of people and goods across the border is a formidable task. CBP must retain the ability to control the ports of entry. But the district court's order in this case seeks to limit or eliminate CBP's ability to do its job. The court held that two sections of the Immigration and Nationality Act, sections 1158 and 1225, apply to non-citizens outside the United States. And thus, CBP has an inflexible statutory obligation to bring in non-citizens from foreign contiguous territory and inspect them for admission, regardless of a port of entry's capacity to do so. That was wrong, and this court should reverse.
Can I ask you about that? So I know the government's position is 1158 applies to immigrants inside the United States, 1157 to those outside the United States. But your comment was that it held that 1158 applies to those outside the United States. Is that true, or is it a little more nuanced than that? That the district court said, I mean, basically, like, well, they're close enough. They're basically in the United States. What did the district court actually do in the government's position here?
The district court held that 1225, which says that immigration officers must inspect those who arrive in or who are physically present in the United States, includes people who are in the process of arriving, which includes people who remain in Mexico or are in foreign contiguous territory. And so that was the import and the actual holding that the district court reached below. That's incorrect, just as a matter of statutory interpretation. The statutes say CBP officers must inspect a non-citizen who is present in or who arrives in the United States.
If arrives in means in the United States, then why isn't it just totally redundant? Why do you need the or clause?
So the rule against surplusage is one of the primary theories that the district court relied on. But as an initial matter, we can agree that arrives in and physically present in capture different concepts, but nothing compels or permits an interpretation of either of those terms to mean someone outside the United States. So as we explained in our briefing, the entry fiction is a long-standing aspect of immigration law that says that those who may be physically present in the United States as a matter of fact, nevertheless may not be present by operation of law. And so if Congress had written a statute that just says someone who is present in may apply for asylum or must be inspected by an immigration officer, they risk an interpretation of the statute that would allow the class members here, people who have just crossed the border and are coming into the country as an arriving non-citizen, to not be inspected. So as a belt and suspenders approach, Congress included both of those phrases to prevent against the risk that the statute would be interpreted so as not to apply to individuals who have just crossed into the place. And so just
can I take us back a minute and ask like a bigger overarching question? Mm-hmm. It seems like the PI was in place for a long time. This injunction has now been in place. What is still at stake here? Like, can you just explain what the status of things is and how many people still would have some effect of anything we do here?
DHS is still going through the retrospective aspect of the district court's injunction. I'm not sure of the precise numbers of how many people remain. But there is still a retrospective obligation to identify people where the transit rule applied to them.
And that was the number I remember was 26,000. Now maybe that's been watered down since then.
So that was the potential subclass as a whole, which included people who were yet to come into the country, and that was an estimate. So those people who were yet to come into the country at the initial appeal. We're talking right now about just the retrospective aspect of the order, because DHS and the Department of Justice have rescinded the transit rule, so there's no longer an occasion to apply that rule prospectively. So the prospective aspect of the injunction that requires the government to not apply it to people who come in, that's just because there is no longer a transit rule to apply on a prospective basis. But the government is still under an obligation to identify those.
Do all parties agree that that's moot?
We haven't briefed the issue. I'm not sure what the basis would be. The rule's been rescinded, so the government isn't applying it to people who come into the country, you know, from the date of rescission forward. So it's just a matter of finding those people who had the rule applied to them, and in the words of the district court, reopening or reconsidering their cases.
But it's going to be some number that's less than 26,000, perhaps significant. I don't know if significant.
I think it's certainly less than 26,000. I don't want to suggest.
So what was in, help me also understand, just to kind of dovetail off that, what was enjoined? Was it the metering rule or was it the transit rule?
So the preliminary injunctions, the two preliminary injunctive orders, were injunctive orders that prevented the government first from applying the transit rule to those who would have entered the United States before the rule took effect, except for the fact that they were metered. And the second preliminary injunction was an order to go back and find the people who had the rule permissively applied to them before the first PI was issued or while it was stayed by this court, and to reconsider and reopen their cases. Those were all wrapped up into the final injunction, which is now part of the final judgment that's on appeal. So that's the injunctive issue that's still on appeal. There's also the declaratory judgment that says that turnbacks is a
district. Should we just stay with the injunction for a second to clarify what's going on? So what is your understanding of what the injunction requires the government to do as to people who have actually been removed from the country, who are now in other countries? What do you think you have to do on this injunction?
The government has to identify those people, and in the district court's words, reopen or reconsider the cases. So it's a fact-specific inquiry, but the import of the injunction is it requires...
Sorry, but when you say identify those people who were turned away under the metering rule, but then later had the transit rule applied to them.
That's right. It's individuals who would have entered the United States, but for the fact that there were...
Is that even doable, by the way?
It's not easy. That was the focus of the preliminary injunctive appeal. I think, though, if I could, there's much more at stake in this appeal than just the injunctive relief and unwinding past applications of the transit rule. The district court reasoned that 1158 and 1225 apply to non-citizens who are outside the United States. So as a practical matter, that interpretation of the statute has, I think, significantly far-reaching effects, one potential example of which was the injunctive relief that the court issued. But I want to make clear that...
Your position is what makes this different is it wasn't likely of success on the merits. The district court granted summary judgment.
Correct.
Right. So that's the plaintiff's 706-1 argument.
Correct. The court granted summary judgment for plaintiffs on their 706-1 claim and their due process claim, and then entered the injunctive relief as a due process remedy. So that's the full scope of...
Do we need to decide that question? You have an alternative argument that, I guess, the reasonableness argument, which I guess the district court said was not properly before it. Is there a way we could rule on that and not address the 706-1 argument?
I don't see how. The district court denied the 706-2 claim as moot in light of its decision on the 706-1 claim, which says that metering under any circumstance is unlawful. So we're not even looking at whether metering is lawful in some cases but not others, and maybe is being implemented in an arbitrary or capricious manner. The district court held that 1158, 1225 impose obligations on non-citizens outside the United States. CBP unlawfully failed to comply with those obligations, regardless of the circumstances, and that is the scope of the court's holding. So it didn't even say that maybe in some cases a port of entry might be overwhelmed and that might justify delaying the entry of some non-citizens.
So that's what I wanted to ask you on the follow-up on Jeff Nelson's question. Could this panel assume, for the purposes of argument, that the district court's reading of 1157 was correct? Not saying it is, just assuming it. But under 706-1, it was not a withheld action. Instead, it was a delayed action. And because there's been, as far as I can tell, almost no briefing in the district court on delay, certainly no analysis by the district court other than that footnote, which I'm still trying to understand exactly what was litigated below. So both parties are probably going to be asking that question. Why couldn't we do that? Just say, look, we'll assume for the purpose of argument it applies. It's not withheld. It's delayed. There's been no analysis. It's delayed under the track factors. Send it back.
That would still require the court to make the determination of whether the statute applies in the first place.
Well, that's what we assume. Let's say we assume it did. For the purposes of the argument, why can't we decide this case on delay and assume that the statute applies.
I think the court only gets there if it determines that the statute applies to non-citizens outside the United States.
No, I'm saying we would assume that it did.
Right, and this is the core of the government's appeal.
I understand. I'm just saying, but we make a call, not you, on how we decide cases. So let's say we assume, without deciding, that they're reading the statute is correct. We're not holding that it is. We're simply assuming that it is. But we say, but even if their reading is correct, it's not a withheld action. It's potentially a delayed action, and there's been no analysis of the delay.
If we're in a world where the court is assuming that 1225 was correctly interpreted by the district court, then our argument is that the court should remand, or rather, the district court erred by not engaging in the arbitrary and capricious analysis. At this point, though, all of the policy memoranda that governed that implementation of metering has been rescinded and superseded. So our position is that that claim is actually moved for different reasons than what the district court said, but because an arbitrary and capricious claim looks specifically at the way that the government is acting, right, to determine whether it's...
I think that Joe might be asking a slightly different thing than I understand you to be answering. I think you're talking about the 702.
Right, so.
and he's talking, I think, about unreasonable delay. So it seems like if the reasonableness of any delay has not yet been litigated, which seems to be the situation, I think he's asking... Could we remand now to litigate the reasonableness of the delay?
That, I thank you for the clarification. I think the general response is still the same, because the government, the factual record has changed. And so the way the government might have been implementing metering before, looking at under the track factors, is no longer the way it's implementing it's complying with its statutory obligations now. So I think that would require the district court to basically reopen the case.
Well, and I'm just wondering, because they're arguing in their briefs that it violates 706.1. I mean, the first heading in the brief is this violates 706.1. 706.1 says withheld or unreasonably delayed. And the unreasonable delay was never analyzed. So it seems to me before we can even decide if there was a 706.1 violation, we have to decide whether it was withheld or delayed. And as far as I can tell, that analysis never really happened.
The district court said that it was unlawfully withheld as to everyone. Our position would be that even if the obligation applies, this is it's a big border, right? There's about 2 dozen ports of entry, and the factual defenses that the government might raise at one port of entry as to on one day or one week or one month or whatever one slice of time you look at might be completely different than the factual defenses it might raise at another port of entry.
Well, and how could the district court say that? Because, I mean, we have to show that all, whatever that number is, smaller than 26,000, none of them got back into the United States, because if they appeared again and sought asylum, wouldn't that undermine the district court's holding, or is that not analogous to that argument?
I think, I'm not sure it's analogous, but what undermines the finding that it was unlawfully withheld on a class-wide basis is the fact that CBP continued to inspect individuals for inadmissibility during the time that it was metering and refer them for credible fear proceedings to USCIS. So just as a matter of undisputed...
But only if they fell within the... Only if they felt, got the golden ticket, they were first in line and met the metering restrictions. And I think the class members are, those individuals are excluded from the class, aren't they?
The class is individuals who were turned back, right? It makes no distinction about individuals.
Right.
And
so,
who are still seeking to have access to the asylum process, right? So there are the people who still don't have access, I thought.
There may be, there may not be. But the class by its own terms has no ending. And it isn't
but once someone gets asylum, they're no longer in the class, right? The definition itself excludes the people who actually are considered.
I think that's right.
I have a lot of questions on the track I was trying to go on before, because I really don't understand the scope of what your obligations are. So I'm trying to figure out this reopening and reconsideration, what it actually means. So for people outside the country, can you go back to what you were saying you think your obligations?
So to reopen and reconsider closed cases. There's been, discussion between the parties and the district court about what that entails as to different non-citizens, but that's the basis of that is the direct command that the district court imposed. I don't want to misspeak or misrepresent what exactly is going on below. There's been a lot of things that have happened since the summary judgment order, so I'm happy to provide more supplemental briefing on what that might be, but I'm afraid I can't provide much more specificity than that about what it requires us to individuals outside the country.
Okay, well, so how about inside then? So My understanding is if someone's case, there seems to be like a different way that different parts of the government may be defining this reopening and reconsideration. Like if someone's case is still in progress, maybe it's the BIA hasn't ruled yet but it's pending before them. Are you calling that reopening and reconsidering even though the case isn't over? I think you are.
Our position was that if the case was still ongoing, if it's not final and closed, that it's not so much not so much a reopening or reconsideration as it is just an interference with the way that immigration judges or asylum officers are applying the statute. But because the rule's been rescinded, right, I'm not even sure whether that situation as a factual matter is still happening.
Well, that was what I was trying to ask about how many people are still affected. It seems like there shouldn't be that many cases that are still in progress where you would need to do something you didn't want to do. They should all be over, as far as I can tell.
I'm not sure whether I think many of them are final and closed, and that's the issue with the order to reopen and reconsider.
Okay, so you think there are people inside the United States who haven't actually been removed, but for whom you have to do some new asylum process?
There certainly were. I'm not sure how many, if any, are still here, but there certainly were, and that was a significant...
And so, if you can't answer that, how do we know whether the injunctive part of any of this is moot?
I think even if the government has finished complying with its obligations under an injunction, I don't think that automatically means the government can no longer appeal from that injunction, but even if that is what that meant, we're still appealing from the declaratory judgment.
I understand that, and we could talk about that, but I'd like to just understand whether the injunctive part of this is even still live. I really don't understand from any of your answers yet what the obligations are outside the country or inside the country, and who's at stake and how many at all. So maybe you could try again to explain what's at stake with the injunction?
Sure. For people inside the country who had the transit rule applied to their case, but wouldn't have had it applied to their case if they'd entered before the effective date because of metering, the government has to identify them. So that's the first.
Identifying them, though, doesn't seem like it interferes with anything. That's like an obligation. I don't see how that is barred by F1.
But maybe not identifying, but the order is to reopen them or reconsider. So the court's order disturbs closed and final removal orders or expedited removal orders, either one of the two, right?
Back to the question about if it's still in progress, because we have a lot of cases that say we can decide things about what the rules for asylum are. It sounds kind of like you're saying you're not worried about the cases still in progress. Everything's okay with them. Is that what you're saying? But I don't think that's what your brief said, but maybe that is what you're saying now.
That was not what I intended to say. I think the cases that were in progress, and I'm just not sure how many of those are still in progress, right, that would have the transit rule applied to them, because the rule's been rescinded. I think that's the prospective application of the rule.
Well, but the rule's been rescinded going forward. Has it been rescinded retroactively?
No, not retroactively.
Yeah, so, isn't that the whole issue?
But if a case is ongoing, right, while the rule was rescinded, and I'm not sure how many of those cases that there were, but if the case is ongoing while the rule is rescinded, that's a different factual situation than a case that closed and then the rule was rescinded at a later date. The court's order that's still in effect applies to that group of cases, the ones that closed, and then subsequently, the transit rule was rescinded. So the government has to go back, find those people, and reopen or reconsider closed cases. That's precisely what 1252F1 prohibits for all of them, and it also varies in 1252A2A and E for expedited removal orders and 1252A5 and B9 for orders in full removal proceedings. That's what those statutes were.
So, for people who have a final order of removal but have not been removed, is there a step before the actual removal where the government makes sure that everything has been done properly in the proceeding? Is there some review of the file before you actually send the person out?
I don't think in every single case, but there was, at one point, there was the development of a master list, and then, kind of a calling down from there about which individuals might be subject to the district court's injunction on the prospective or retrospective basis.
I guess I'm asking separately from this injunction, as a general matter, when someone has a final order of removal but hasn't been removed, before they're actually removed, is there some making sure that the times were dotted and the T's were crossed?
I don't think so. I think a final removal order is a final removal order, and it allows Immigration and Customs Enforcement to effectuate that order. So I think unless there's perhaps a motion, sometimes, I know different courts of appeals have different auto stays, so I don't want to make a categorical representation, but you know, in terms of, you know, does ICE do anything on its own, I think unless there's some kind of administrative or judicial process separate, you know, going on, I see my time is about to expire.
No, keep going.
Unless there's some kind of separate process that's going on, I think that generally a final removal order is a final removal order.
But so for people who are still, say, waiting for the BIA, you know, they're appealing to the BIA right now, you're not disagreeing that it is, well, maybe you are, but you would tell me, is there anything wrong with an injunction that tells the BIA that the asylum rules can't have the third country transit rule, and so when they get this appeal, you can't apply it?
Yes, because 1252F1 prohibits class-wide injunctions that interfere with the way the government implements covered provisions. Removal proceedings take place pursuant to 1229A, which is a covered provision in F1. And so
But if it's an asylum proceeding, they're not removed yet, or it's an asylum proceeding. I mean, we have cases about collateral effects on asylum rules that say it is okay to have an injunction. I'm not understanding why this wouldn't fall under that if it's just what asylum rules should be applied to the person when it's still in progress.
That line of cases is readily distinguishable from the case here. So orders about adjustment of status might be have only a collateral effect on removal proceedings. The injunction here is directed to asylum officers in USCIS and immigration judges within the BIA, and it orders them directly, not even a stretch. It orders them directly. It says you shall reopen or reconsider cases.
But let's put aside the ones that are done, the ones that are still in progress. I think we have cases all the time that interpret the law as to asylum and other things, but, you know, what is wrong with a court saying what the asylum rules are, and thus what the BIA and the IJ have to do? I mean, it could be about social group, it could be about anything. I don't understand why, for cases, forget the reopen, just the in progress cases, why that's not collateral.
So for cases that might come to this one, right, through the PFR process, through A5 and B9, that's Congress specifically channeled jurisdiction to the courts of appeals, and specifically took district courts out of the picture, right? District courts are specifically, you know, removed from who may issue orders relating to removal proceedings. And the idea is that if there was some kind of error by the BIA or an immigration judge in removal proceedings, this court, the appropriate court of appeals, would have jurisdiction to review all questions of law or fact, as long as they're wrapped up in the final removal order and kind of zipped up to the court of appeals. The district courts can't enter class-wide injunctions, or really any injunctions, as to removal proceedings. That's what Congress intended. Because
your point is that we'd have to deal with these on a case-by-case basis.
That would be
what Congress has said, and that the district court can't just enter these. But how do we know? I think what's confusing me here, or what's troubling me, I don't even know, is that the district court said you had an affirmative obligation to go out and find these individuals. I mean, if the district court says, your position is the district court can't even say what it said. It doesn't even have authority to do that.
That's right.
But say we said that. Say we struck down one case comes up and we say the third party transit rule is not consistent with the statute. Wouldn't the government then go in based on our rule and reopen those cases on its own? You're just saying you wouldn't be bound by an injunction.
I think a couple points. Do you mean this court in a typical petition for review, or this court in this?
Well, I think that's what. I mean, I'm just trying to follow your argument that hey, Congress set up this scheme where we have to address these things individually. Okay, let's say that this came up individually. What would your obligation have been then? If we had we wouldn't have issued an injunction, but say we decided the first case and there were 10,000 behind it. Would the government have stepped in and said, oh, the Ninth Circuit has spoken, we need to step in and figure out what we do with these other 10,000 cases?
So in that situation, right, there's not a class-wide injunctive order. So I think putting that aside, I think generally immigration judges comply with the law of the circuit where they sit. So if this court were in a properly filed PFR to issue that legal interpretation, I think you can presume, right? I don't want to speak categorically, but I think you can probably presume that immigration judges in the normal course would account for that ruling in future PFRs. In terms of the direct order in that case, right, the order would just be remanded to the Board of Immigration Appeals, which would then either review the case or remand it further down to the IJ, and redo it all again. So in that specific case, it would be, you know, the actual proceedings would proceed as the court ordered. In future similar cases within the Ninth Circuit, then you could, I think, probably maybe presume, I don't want to speak categorically, but I think probably immigration judges would follow that. But that's not...
And has that not happened? We haven't had a single case outside of it. I mean, I don't understand why the plaintiffs haven't tried this. Is it like a belt and suspenders to come up with an individual case and bring this to the Ninth Circuit and determine how it applies in the case? There's no case where we've addressed this issue.
Well, so that's what the non-citizen in the Mendoza-Linares case tried to do. The issue in his case was he had an expedited order. So he tried to file a PFR, but there is no judicial review under 1252A2A for orders of expedited removal. So that's the kind of the difference in
so
which...
That's the hurdle that they're facing.
That's one of them, right? That's for people with orders of expedited removal who have the transit rule applied to them. Like Mendoza-Linares controls says that no review of the expedited removal order, including the credible fear determination, without exception.
And that's why they went to the district court to get classified, because they couldn't do the strategy I'm suggesting they couldn't really pursue.
I had a couple kind of structural questions for you. First, if we were to agree with your reading of the statute, getting back to the beginning,
yes,
if we read 1157 your way, then as far as you're concerned, this case is over.
That's right.
So just done. All the stuff about the declaratory relief injunction, the scope of this injunction, that it's just if we decide the merits one way or the other. I understand. If we decide the merits they wanted the way they want, then we have to get into what that exactly means. If we decide the way you want, as far as you're concerned, the case is over.
That's right. A merits decision in our favor means that the statutes don't apply to non-citizens outside the United States, which means that CBP has no obligation under 706.1 to inspect them, and that doesn't matter whether it's unlawfully withheld or reasonable delay, because under the Norton decision, there has to be an obligation in the first place. So a merits decision in our favor sweeps out the 706.1 and 706.2 claims. We think it does also with the due process claim. We have different grounds, and I can go into those. But the due process clause, our position is that, you know, the due process clause doesn't apply to non-citizens in another country. So there are, I think, the due process rights don't attach to class members who are still in Mexico. And even if they did, once you come into the United States, the Mendoza-Linares decision confirms that the Constitution, the only rights that attach to those individuals are those given by Congress. So it's at most a statutory violation.
And if we were to find in your favor saying that the statutes do apply, but that the delay in implementing was reasonable, then I take it the case is also over.
If we were
to say that the statutes, we take their reading of the statute, but we say under 706.1, it wasn't withheld, and any delay was reasonable, therefore there's not a 706.1 violation, then this case is also over.
That's right. That's judgment for the government. On the 706.1.
Correct. I understand there's 706.2 and it all, yes, but this is the one that we're really, I mean, there are other claims. The one we've been talking about is the 706.1.
Yes.
And I'm not trying to complicate this case more. Class certification is not before us right now in terms of appeal, but what is the status of the class certification?
But if the class is certified, we haven't challenged it, you know, per se under the four corners of the decision. I do think our standing brief talks about how, at minimum, the decision, the relief that was granted to the class is overbroad. But I think if the court were to find that at least one member of the class has standing to pursue the declaratory or injunctive relief, and TransUnion's is yet to analyze both, but if the court were to find that one member of the class has standing to pursue prospective relief, then we think the court should just go ahead and reach the merits. Because I think, as Your Honor pointed out, the merits, right, the statutory interpretation, everything rises and falls with the statutory interpretation.
But do you have any argument that Beatrice Doe doesn't have standing?
1252F1 says that the only relief that can be granted is to non-citizens against whom, an individual non-citizen against whom proceedings have been initiated. So we didn't brief this. I recognize that, you know, we don't necessarily concede it, but I recognize we didn't brief it. But we think, you know, 1252F1 could potentially cover that individual. But we haven't challenged that aspect of the injunction.
But that's kind of a different, I mean, you may have a you may call it jurisdictional that F1 prohibits injunctions or something, but that's really, I think that's a merits argument. It doesn't seem like you have an argument that Beatrice Doe doesn't have an ongoing injury, it didn't at the time the case was filed, isn't concretely harmed. Those things are satisfied, right?
We haven't raised that argument.
Okay, but that's not quite answering your question.
Right, it's jurisdictional, so we have to.
We have to.
Is Beatrice Doe concretely harmed and has an ongoing injury, at least, I mean, maybe there's a mootness problem, but at least for standing at the time it's filed, she's still trying to get asylum, and she's still outside.
So we don't raise any argument about injury in fact. It's more, it's the redressability.
Which really is like whether you can get an injunction.
Right.
Which is the F1.
But in terms of Article 3 standing, you are saying that Beatrice Doe has Article 3 standing.
We didn't challenge that on appeal. I can't say on
appeal. I know, but we can't say it wasn't challenged in appeal, so we assume it. We actually have to decide it. So you kind of need to give us an answer. Do you believe that Beatrice Doe has Article 3 standing?
The district court said that, I think this was a puzzling aspect of the remedies opinion, the district court said that 1252F1 only permits relief as to an individual non-citizen against whom proceedings have been initiated. But Beatrice Doe is not a person against whom proceedings have been initiated. So I think our redressability argument applies to her as well.
But you think she does not have Article 3 standing?
Because of the redressability issue. But
only because you think this merits thing about injunctions not being available.
Right. Which, and if the court disagrees with that, I think it should just go ahead and reach the merits. I think the merits is the quickest way through.
You don't want us to go out on a jurisdiction. You've got to be a little more candid with us, though, because like, we can't just give you a merits-based ruling because you want one. We actually have to have the power to do that. It's kind of like in the Constitution and stuff. So, like, what is the basis? You're just saying it's only the redressability issue.
I think it's the plaintiff's burden, right, to establish their Article 3 standing. It's our burden to show on appeal. Right? Our standing.
A case that would roll this into the merits as opposed to... Because it is true that sometimes standing and merits... What would be the case that you would point us to say this should be analyzed as a merits decision rather than a standing decision?
So this court's recent decision in Olean, O-L-E-A-N, there's a footnote in there I think that says that if the court satisfies itself that at least one plaintiff in a class has standing for prospective relief, then the court need not decide whether everyone else does, which is why we think that even if the class is overbroad and the court finds, though, that means that the court has found that at least one person has standing. So on that basis, we think the court should go ahead and reach the merits.
So you think someone has Article 3 standing?
I think the court may very well.
All right. Unless my colleagues have... we're going to have you back up here. Don't go too far away.
Any other questions at this time?
Yeah. All right. Well, go ahead. I'm sure we're going to have more questions for you, but thank you for hanging in there for, 30-something minutes.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead from the other side. So Ms. Crow, we're going to put 15 on the clock, but... I understand if you go over, you're not stealing time from your co-counsel, okay? So don't start panicking if it gets to 17 or 18.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You have the floor. Well, actually, hold on one second. We got some people stepping out. Just give us 1 second here. And then is there anyone else coming in out there in the hallway? Are we clear out there?
Or are we done, Your Honor?
Good. All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Melissa Crow on behalf of Appellees Cross Appellants. I'm going to address the claims under APA 7061 and 7062, as well as the injunction, in about 15 minutes. And my co-counsel, Bahar Azmi, will address the Alien Tort Statute, due process, and non-statutory review claims in the remaining 5 minutes. Defendants have mischaracterized the issues in this case, the law, and the record. The critical issue in this case is whether the defendants can evade their mandatory statutory obligations to inspect and process asylum seekers by blocking them from setting foot on U.S. soil at ports of entry.
Back up, because I think you've reframed this. I understand why you've reframed it that way, but I think, with all due respect, I think you're the one that's playing a little fast and loose with how the case should be framed up. Because why can't they? I mean, the statute seems very clear that they have to enter the United States. I mean, you're the one. Tell me any case that says the immigration laws under 1158 apply outside of the borders of the United States. Is there any case that has held that?
Your Honor, I can't think of a case off the top of my head. However,
well, off the top of your head, you've been litigating this for 4 years.
Longer than that.
Yeah. Okay. So that's even more time that you have. This shouldn't be off the top of your head. Where's the case that says 11? If there's no case that says 1158 applies outside of the United States, why isn't that the commonsensical approach?
Your Honor, 1158 and 1225 distinguish between people who are physically present in the U.S. and people who are arriving in the U.S.
What is the difference? Arriving in the U.S. means coming into the United States. How can you read that any other way?
I can apply the rule against surplusage.
You already have the government's argument. 1158 isn't a surplusage argument. I want a plain language argument for why arriving in the United States doesn't mean you have to enter into the United States.
I'd like to address the government's argument about the entry fiction, which is a theory that I think the government came up with because neither the law nor the facts are on their side.
Counsel, you got to stop saying that. That's just not true. The law is on their side. You're the one that's trying to stretch the law. There's no case in the history of the United States that supports your position. You're the one in here trying to argue that 1158 applies outside the United States. You can't point to a single case. So I'm fine to hear your argument, but you've got to stop casting aspersions on the government here. You're asking us to stretch the law. Maybe we should, but that doesn't mean that the government is not being authentic in the arguments that they're making.
Your Honor, we are only talking about individuals here who would have arrived.
But they didn't arrive.
They didn't arrive because of the government's obstructive conduct.
Okay, so what? They didn't arrive. That's what the statute says. Where does the statute say that the government can't set up prohibitions on them getting into the United States?
The statute doesn't give them authority to...
Where does it prohibit them from doing that?
Your Honor, the statute requires them to inspect...
When they come into the United States.
We disagree with that interpretation, Your Honor.
But you don't have a single case that supports you.
This is the first time, as far as we know, that the government has turned back individuals at ports of entry. When we first started this case back in July of 2017... the turnbacks were actually happening on U.S. soil. The government,
that's a different case, right?
Well, it's the same case. The government.
But, I mean, those facts are different than what we're dealing with here, or was that... Tell me how that enters into this.
It is the same case. The government, in those days, used a variety of tactics to turn individuals back to Mexico. Once they had arrived at ports of entry, those tactics included physical force, misinformation. People were told that they would be separated from their families if they pursued asylum.
Are we in on any of that? Is that before us? Those facts that you just recited, is that before us?
Those facts are part of the record. Sometime after we filed this case, the government changed its practice and it moved its officers to the limit line. To the actual border.
So they complied
with Mexico.
They read the law. They said if you don't enter the United States, you don't have asylum, and they made sure that didn't happen. I don't understand what the problem is with that.
The problem is that if you read the statute in the way the government is proposing, it is redundant. If I may, take a quick look at the plain language of the statute. Presence is not defined under the Immigration and Nationality Act and thus takes on its plain meaning, which is within the territorial bounds of the United States. And Ninth Circuit precedent in the form of Barrios versus Holder, 581 F3rd 849, confirms that this is the correct reading of the term.
Wait, what's the correct reading? In the
that physical presence is not a term of art. It has... It's it's to be defined based on its plain meaning, which is inside the territory of the United States. By contrast with physically present, or present, which is a static concept, the district court here found that arrives in denotes a process of arrival that encompasses those who would have arrived but for defendant's obstructive conduct.
So under your theory, when does that kick in? 5 feet from the border, 10 feet from the border, 100 yards from the border, 10 miles from the border?
Generally speaking, it clicks in, and the Ninth Circuit panel that considered our stay motion on the preliminary injunction found that I don't dispute that. It is solely persuasive authority. Found that the obligation to inspect and process is triggered at the moment of encounter with the Customs and Border Protection officer.
Well, that just can't be. I mean, that can't be accurate. That just can't be accurate. Because that's an indefinable, it has no bearing on the territorial sovereignty of the United States. I mean, if the border agent's 10 miles into Mexico,
Your Honor, we're not talking about 10 miles into Mexico. We're talking toe-to-toe. In addition, if I can just finish my analysis, the regulations also define the term arriving alien as an applicant for admission who's coming or attempting to come into the United States at a port of entry. Even if class members here are not applicants for admission under 1225A1, they fit within the catch-all of non-citizens who are otherwise seeking admission under 1225A3, whom defendants must also inspect and process.
That's also 1158, right? Or am I misreading that?
The distinction between arriving and present is also in 1158, yes.
Yeah, but that's the whole problem, is that 1158, the Supreme Court couldn't have been clearer on this, that 1158 governs those who are in the United States, and 1157 governs those who are outside of the United States. Am I wrong about that?
I think you are wrong about that, with all due respect, Your Honor, because it would render one or the other categories of individuals mentioned in 1158 redundant. If you take the government's reading at face value, they don't mean arrives
in. You're telling me that the Supreme Court has not said that 1158 applies out to aliens inside the United States, and 1157 applies to those outside the United States.
1157 relates to overseas resettlement of refugees. 1158 applies to asylum seekers who are seeking protection here in the United States.
In the United States.
Right. We don't dispute that the process of seeking protection occurs in the United States. The issue that we are litigating here is whether the government can unilaterally decide that certain individuals aren't allowed to come to the United States to seek protection. If you accept the government's interpretation of 1158 and 1225, it would give the executive branch authority to unilaterally end access to the asylum process at ports of entry, which would violate Congress's mandate, and it would violate the overall statutory scheme governing the inspection and processing of asylum seekers.
So, counsel, let me jump in here. So, again, I'm going to use the word assume. Let's assume for a moment that we agree with you, and that sitting up right on the goal line and preventing them from coming to the end zone, can't do that, all right? Fair enough. Seems to me there's a second problem for you in this case, is that under 7601, the district court believed that turning them away right there, that was the violation. End of story. But there was no discussion by the district court as to why this is withheld versus delay. And there are all kinds of cases. There's this 10th Circuit case, Forest Guardians, that talks about when something is withheld versus when something is delayed. And first, I didn't see anything in district court discussing that distinction. Am I right about that, that discussion didn't happen?
Your Honor, I believe that the district court felt that once it had decided that a turnback constituted a withholding of mandatory action, it didn't need to get to the issue of delay.
See, I guess that's the problem I have, is that there's a whole analysis you have to go through to determine whether something is withheld or delayed, which box it goes into. And I didn't see the district court explain why it wasn't delayed as opposed to withheld.
So that analysis would depend on the track factors, and I'm happy to go through that analysis if
I appreciate that you guys briefed it. The district court never went through those factors, correct?
No, they didn't.
So isn't that kind of a problem? Because this is an inherently factual case. God knows how many facts were in this case. I read the stipulated facts, and it was almost 100 pages long. It seems to me that if that analysis hasn't happened yet, even if you're right on the statute, look, if the government's right on the statute, you're in a tough spot. But if you're right on the statute, there's still part two of this case that's never, at least as I say, has never really been briefed, litigated, nothing.
Your Honor, part of the reason that the district court found that this was a withholding of agency action and didn't feel that it needed to get to the issue of delay is that there was never a guarantee that people could come back to a port of entry and be inspected and processed. The CBP officers at the limit line simply said, go away. We don't have capacity to process you. And yet, the record clearly shows that they did have capacity to process.
See, that gets to the track factors. That's the factual analysis that has to happen.
Your Honor, I don't think so.
You just said the record, but the district court never issued summary judgment on the issue of delay versus withheld.
Well, it did issue summary judgment on the issue of withheld.
Well, but without analyzing whether this should go into the delay box, correct?
It's an either or for a violation of 706.1, and I think
there's case law that talks about whether you analyze it as withheld or whether you analyze it as delayed. There are some times where Congress will say you must have this report on pesticides done by January 1st, 2010, and then 9 years later the EPA still hasn't done it. That's clearly, that might be delayed. Or the agency says, I'm not going to do it. I'm not doing this. That's withheld. Did the district court ever go through that tree of analysis here?
I don't believe so.
Isn't that a problem? For you to win on 706.1, don't you have to convince us at least that there at least shouldn't have been some analysis of delay?
I don't think it's necessary, but I think even if you do that analysis, we win.
Right, and again, the government's response to that is, this is not the time or place. This is a very factual issue. You've got all these different ports of entry. There's no way that this panel, based on this record, can analyze that. You think we can?
I absolutely think you can.
Based on the 3 pages of briefing that we have on that issue.
You might require supplemental briefing on that issue.
But, wouldn't we, to go there, isn't it inherently a factual question, which we would normally remand to the district court if we went this route?
If you went that route, I think it would be helpful to remand to the district court for a finding of fact, but I don't think that you need to go there.
Okay, I understand your argument on that. But wouldn't, in order to find in your favor, wouldn't we have to say that every single time we turned them away, they actually had capacity but were just, lying about it?
We have pretty compelling evidence.
I have no doubt that you could come up with some evidence of, and maybe a lot, but that's sort of the problem, is we don't know. We're talking about 26,000 people, potentially.
Your Honor, the DHS's Office of Inspector General also issued a report confirming that DHS was artificially limiting the flow of migrants at the southern border. Rodney Harris, who was a Rule 30b-6 witness for CBP, testified that when an asylum seeker is turned back, there is no guarantee that he or she will ever be inspected and processed at a later date.
That's a different question than whether anyone ever was. And I guess that's what I'm asking. I'm not sure you're going to convince. If we go to this, I think the best argument is this question is relevant. Because if we decide that it's relevant, I don't see how we could decide this. Now, maybe my colleagues will convince me otherwise, but I mean, that seems way too much in the weeds for what we need to do.
Your Honor, I obviously that is your decision.
Well, I should vote, not my decision.
Excuse me.
Yeah, maybe it would be worth having you tell us why we don't need to reach this.
I don't think that you need to reach this. I mean, we view it as a withholding, as I said. There was a lot of discussion at the stay arguments about whether an individual arrived once or arrived multiple times. And in that decision, the Ninth Circuit found, or that particular panel of the Ninth Circuit found, that every time an individual came to the border, that was an arrival. And that, in some sense, is the basis for the preliminary injunction that I also want to address. And we can go in that direction if you'd like.
I have one follow-up question on the stay decision, which is persuasive but not binding. I don't recall that decision talking about delay versus withheld either.
I don't believe it did.
The basic idea from your perspective, though, is if nothing is pending, there's nothing to be delayed. It's just over. Like, you can try again, but it's just over.
Correct. That Ninth Circuit panel found, based on the plain language of the Act, that an individual's first arrival triggered a statutory right to apply for asylum and have that application considered. And if CBP can forgo inspection upon the first arrival and defer inspection and processing to some unspecified future time, the first arrival loses legal significance. Any other result would permit the defendants to turn back asylum seekers repeatedly or even indefinitely.
So, but I think your argument is they were doing it indefinitely.
They were. That is absolutely our argument.
So I guess I'm trying to understand, the government raises this in the brief to us, and this may not have been briefed in the district court. But you know, imagine a scenario where 5 million people show up on the border. At the time, social media, we're all going to show up at the border the same day. 5 million people show up. And there's no way that the officers on staff can process this. And they have to say, look, you need to come back tomorrow. You can't, we can't, maybe you have to come back 2 weeks from now. You're saying that them saying that is a violation.
Your Honor, that is not the situation that we have before us. There were never 5 million people
to be clear. But don't run away from hypothetical.
I am not running away from the hypothetical.
So what's your answer?
We admit that defendants may not always be in a position to immediately inspect and process asylum seekers arriving at ports of entry. But that isn't what this case is about. The record shows that defendants
Hold on again. Now we're kind of running away from the hypothetical. That's a hypothetical. 5 million people show up. There's no possible way they can process them. Don't talk about the record in this case. Talk about the hypothetical. As soon as they turn away one of those people, that's a violation?
Number one, they could allow those people to wait in line, as they do with U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents.
They're going to say, look, you know, it's going to be, could be 3-4 weeks, which was similar to the case here. Now I'm bringing the case back. Again, hypothetical is 5 million people show up. There's no way that the officers on duty can process and interview that many people. They have to tell people, we can't see you today, we can't see you tomorrow, we can't even see you next week. That's an error, that you're saying that's a violation.
It is not inconceivable that the government could set up some sort of appointment system, but they cannot prevent people from coming to the border.
So you're saying it would be a violation if they said, we can't process you today, there are too many people.
It would depend on the circumstances. But I will note that CBP is the largest U.S. law enforcement agency in the country, and that Border Patrol, which is responsible for apprehending people who enter between ports of entry, processes literally thousands of people per day. The Office of Field Operations, which is the entity of CBP that deals with people at ports of entry, is held to a very different standard. I would also note that in 2022, when there was an influx of Ukrainians, the Office of Field Operations processed 20,000 Ukrainians in a month. As I said before, it is very standard for U.S. citizens and lawful permanent residents to wait in line. The line does sometimes go into Mexico. The same is true of the vehicular lanes. It is only asylum.
They are entering the United States. If say they were standing in line and the line went back a mile, would they be arriving in the United States by standing at the back of that line a mile away from the border?
No, Your Honor, I don't think they would. They would need to interact with the Customs and Border Protection official. But the situation that we're dealing with here isn't about waiting in line. People were told to go away, and they were given no game plan, no route for coming back, no date, no appointment, no nothing. I'm conscious that my time is running.
Don't worry about the time.
Can we talk about the scope of the injunction for
Yes. Yes, I'd really like to do that. I want to start by clarifying the 26,000 number. My understanding is that was the number of people who were on wait lists in Mexico at the time that the transit rule was implemented. Not all of those people are class members.
This is helpful for you to walk through all this, but how many are we talking about here? I think that's what we're trying to grapple with, is this is a big case, and it's like, is it actually having any real impact on the ground? And can you clarify that for us?
So the first thing that I want to clarify is that there was a division of labor in terms of identifying and providing notice to we'll call them the PI, whether it's preliminary injunction or permanent injunction class members in this case. The government was tasked, and there weren't two preliminary injunctions. There was a preliminary injunction and then a clarification order. The government was tasked with identifying and providing notice to people who were still in the United States, who were going through proceedings and were at some stage of them, whether early or late. It's the plaintiffs who were tasked with the much more difficult undertaking of identifying people who had either been deported or left the country, who were outside the United States. The information that the plaintiffs needed to identify class members outside the United States was uniquely within defendants' possession. And we fought for more than 3 years to get that information. By the time we got the so-called master list, many more of the PI class members had been deported, which increased the burden on plaintiffs to do outreach and provide meaningful notice. We did check in with agency counsel.
But all of that you're talking about falls within the 26,000. I mean, the 26,000 is the outer reach of what we're dealing with?
Yes, but I don't think the number of people ultimately affected reaches 26,000.
Well, that's what I'm trying to understand. I maybe it doesn't matter because if it's one person or 1,000 people, I guess the issue is just the same. But how many are we really dealing with?
So the government has a very detailed spreadsheet that they shared, I think, about 6 months ago. They were required to go back through cases that were pending before immigration judges, the Board of Immigration Appeals, and so forth, or at different stages of proceedings, credible fear proceedings before USCIS, and figure out who was metered. Because that's what we're talking about with the preliminary injunction, is preventing people from being subject to the transit rule if the only reason that they were subject to it was that they were previously metered. In other words, if they would have entered the country prior to the implementation of the transit rule, but for metering, they should be put back in the position that they would have been. It would have absolved the court of the ability to do anything for them at the end of this case if they became ineligible for asylum by virtue of the fact that they were metered. What's more, when they were metered, the government told them to go back and,
you know. We understand that, but
yeah.
The thing is, this is like going on for 5 years or something. So how are there still people left? This is what I don't understand. How many people still have things that are going to happen to them if the injunction is upheld?
So three of those years, we were waiting for information from the government. We did check in with agency counsel, not Mr. Alaska, a different agency counsel last week, to find out what the status of their work was, and it is still in progress. They have identified a number of cases and have taken appropriate action in those cases, as I understand it. But there are still some cases on their list that they are working through.
Is that like a handful? I mean, when you say some, is it like five?
I defer to the government for that information, but it's a pretty hefty Excel spreadsheet that is under seal.
Can you describe from your perspective what needs to happen for those people still?
Again, that process, I mean, it depends what stage of the process the government's review.
I mean, we may all have different views, but I'm really struggling with understanding how much of this injunction is just about applying the right asylum rules to people who have something happening to them, as opposed to requiring a whole procedure that wouldn't have happened otherwise. And, like, I think you're speaking past each other a little bit, but, like, I think that the line is probably completely closed proceedings that need to be started over, I think, is maybe the way that the government was trying to say it today. If you disagree with that, please explain why.
I'm not 100% sure I understand your question, but I will take a stab.
I mean, maybe let me try again then. So, we may not agree about this, but it seems to me that you can have an injunction that talks about what the asylum rules are. You may not be able to have an injunction that says someone who's already removed, I don't know, maybe you still can, but someone who's already removed has to be brought back by a plane ticket, or someone whose case is entirely closed, the government has to go and ask for a new proceeding or something. But a case is just ongoing, I think it's okay to say what the law is. So I don't understand what's going on here, about what's in what bucket and how many people.
So I can only speak to the people, or I can speak most authoritatively to the people who are outside the country. It took a very long time for the government to come up with procedures, and some of those procedures were negotiated with plaintiff's counsel. We have undertaken a very thorough effort to try to identify those class numbers. Based on the government's master list, the bulk of those people are from four countries, Honduras, El Salvador, Ecuador, and Guatemala. We have done Facebook pages, and we've worked with a technology outfit called Mobile Pathways to send text messages to the extent that we had cell phone numbers for these people. We are on the verge of releasing a campaign that has been created by a Salvadoran media organization that will run radio and social media ads in these four countries. There's like a TikTok video and a survey that people have to fill out. Once the survey is filled out, it comes to our team. We review it to confirm that the person, you know, entered within the relevant dates and was, in fact, subject to the transit rule. And at that point, there is a form that gets filled out and goes to the government, and they do a review. It's called an alotrolado motion to reconsider, I believe, or motion to reopen. It is only at that juncture, if the government agrees with our assessment, that they would then have to conduct another interview with the individual. And if they find that the person is, in fact, a class member, and that the proceedings do need to be reopened, there is an arrangement whereby they would send the individual a form to get travel authorization to enter for purposes of those proceedings.
And does that mean the government would pay to bring them here?
No.
So it means that the government would need to consider an application from this person if they got it.
Well, the government would need to consider the application, the alotrolado motion, before they got here. And a lot of that would happen over email or telephonically or, you know, however they're able to communicate.
But then if they cross that hurdle, the goal would be for an asylum application to be considered for that person that I guess otherwise wouldn't be allowed to be filed other than for this case, because they would have already had one, and there's a bar on second ones or something. Like, how is it different than what someone could do if this case didn't exist?
So an individual could conceivably come back to a court and not, they would have presumably a final order, an expedited removal order. they could come back to a port of entry without having their removal order reinstated. But there are a lot of risks to that. If they don't have travel authorization, it's going to be really hard for them to go back to Mexico. There is likely to be a taint on the subsequent credible fear proceedings if they're put back into expedited removal because of this prior order. They are likely to be detained at the border if they come back on their own. I think that those are the major drawbacks.
So, and what I'm wondering is, are you saying that even without this case, someone who is part of the class, you know, was metered and was denied asylum because of the transit rule, if they found their way back and tried again, they could try again. But because if they can try again, then maybe that's good for you, because it's like the government isn't doing something you wouldn't otherwise do. It would just be applying the rules to them or something. But if they have to do a whole new thing, it seems more invasive of the governance. I'm not sure whether... I think you're defending what this case is doing for people, but I don't know if that helps you. It seems like the more this case is requiring the government to do something that it wouldn't otherwise do, the harder it is to have that injunction.
Your Honor, the only thing we're asking the government to do is to rectify the impact of metering in this case. In terms of the people outside the country, it's going to be a very small number because it has been inordinately difficult to locate them.
So wait, it's a small number because you can't locate them, or it's a small number because a lot of them have come back and re-entered?
I don't know. I don't know where they are, and that has been the whole problem. But the fact that 3 years passed before we got any identifying information decreased the likelihood that we were going to find many of them.
Why can't these issues just be litigated in the normal process before the IJs and the BIAs and then come up to us? Why does this have to be injunctive relief? Why can't they try and re-enter, and then we litigate in those specific cases, as 99% of our immigration cases are done, on what the law is?
Your Honor, it's simply unjust to ask these people to incur the expense and the risk of coming back to the border and the taint of their proceedings after having...
I mean, if they come back and the metering rule was inconsistent with the statute, then that's the law. Like, I don't understand. I mean, what you have this presumption that the immigration judges and the BIA wouldn't actually apply the law correctly. If we said that's what the law is, they would have to comply with that. I think the problem here is you've tried to get class-wide relief, and if we open up the door here, what other doors are we opening up to class-wide relief in situations like this? Why shouldn't they be litigated in their individual cases?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if you're moving toward the 1252F1 discussion, but we do feel very strongly that this injunction is not covered by 1252F1. Because of the collateral effects exception. The district court properly found, we believe, that the injunction directly implicated 1158B2C, under which the transit rule was promulgated, not the operation of procedures for removal proceedings. And it preserved the substantive requirements for asylum eligibility that would have applied at the time the class members were metered. In Alemán González, which is where these restrictions on injunctions came from, the Supreme Court explicitly preserved the Ninth Circuit's collateral effects doctrine. So F1 does not bar class-wide injunctions of the unlawful operation of a provision not specified in F1, even if the injunction has a collateral effect on the operation of a covered provision or in removal proceedings. And the cases cited in, I think it's footnote 4 of Alemán González, are directly relevant here. In González versus DHS, which is a Ninth Circuit case from 2007, This court affirmed the district court's authority to enjoin the unlawful application of an adjustment of status provision, 8 U.S.C. 1255 little I, which is under Part 5 of the Act, even though the end result was that the decision prohibited reinstatement of removal, which is covered by one of the provisions in Part 4. Similarly, in Catholic Social Services versus INS, also a Ninth Circuit decision, the court upheld the injunction against an adjustment of status policy issued under 8 U.S.C. 1255A, even though the injunction prohibited removal of class members under a provision of Chapter 4. But it was a downstream consequence of the rejection of the adjustment of status applications. And that is exactly what's going on here. The impact on removal or expedited removal is a downstream consequence of fixing the unlawful metering problem, which was the only reason that people were subject to the transit rule in the first place.
So maybe I could try my question again. So I understand that your position is basically this metering never should have happened, so the third country transit rule never should have been applied to these people, and basically anything done to fix that is okay because it's all just fixing that. And I think that's a coherent position, and maybe we'll agree with you. But if we think you have gone a little too far, so say you just think, okay, you can do a lot to remedy something, but you can't change the removal provision. Because of that one, there's like some things you can't do as a remedy because it gets too close to the provision. That's what my questions were trying to get at. Like, what are the procedures that are being required here, and how close are they to the covered the provisions of F1? Like, it feels like you might be able to parse some of these remedies, as some of them are just notice that has nothing to do with removal. You know, some of them are like, apply to a lot of people who are still in progress. That seems, you know, but if you have to set up a whole new process for people, it might start to get into things that maybe can't be a remedy under F1, that may be a novel question that this case presents. So can you speak to that? Have I articulated it better now?
Sorry if I misunderstood, Your Honor. In terms of the cases of people inside the United States, the government obviously had a head start in identifying those people, and my understanding is that many of them were in proceedings at the time they came to the government's attention.
And so hopefully all those people are taken care of, right?
Hopefully, and again, I defer to the government on the status of that. The last information we got was 6 months ago, and you know, time has passed since then, but I think the process is ongoing.
So you're saying there may still be people inside the country for whom the injunction is actually still changing the law that's going to apply to them, even though the government doesn't want to do these rules anymore?
Possibly, Your Honor, yes. And I would just... I would distinguish the case of Mendoza-Linares, which Mr. Halaska mentioned, because that individual was not metered. So it's a fundamentally different case than those of our class members. The other thing that I would point out is that in addition to the injustice of the transit rule and the illegality for any number of reasons that other courts have now ruled on, if you look at the plain language of the transit rule, It shouldn't apply to people who are in our class member situation. And that was really the basis for the district court's ruling.
All right, we're going to give you a break. Thank you for hanging in there. Counsel, you can go over 5 minutes, but you're not going to go 40. And so we'll give everyone a break. If anyone needs to leave, this is a... don't mean to leave on this fine gentleman's argument, but some of you have been here for a long time, so.
Thank you, Your Honor. Bahar Azmi, on behalf of the appellants, athletes cross appellants. I will be addressing the alien tort statute to process a non-statutory review, and I understand from the intensive questions around the injunction and the statutory interpretation, my issues may not be the showstopper here. But nevertheless, I think there are important precedential questions, and I'd like to start with the alien tort statute.
Just to tee it up a little more, if we don't agree, I mean, if we agree with 706.1, do we need to get to these
other, if we affirmed the district court on 706-1, would we need to reach these other issues? I guess we would, because it was summary judgment on each issue. This isn't an injunction issue.
Correct, Your Honor. It's on summary judgment. I think we would say with respect to due process, we certainly would like an affirmance, but given the complexity of the issue that I would hope to get to at some point, you wouldn't necessarily have to reach it, maybe even in terms of a constitutional avoidance question. And in terms of the ATS, again, I think you wouldn't necessarily have to reach it if we got full relief under 706-1, excuse me. But because, as I hope to address, there's, I think, a pretty fundamental error that the district court made with respect to international law that goes beyond this case, we would like the court to give consideration to that error. And then non-statutory review, as I will describe, sort of rises and falls with the 706-2 analysis. So if the court were going to remand on 706-2, we would want that to be accompanied with an instruction that the court address the non-statutory review arguments on remand.
So the district court, I mean, you want rules in your favor, but for the relief in this case, is there any different relief that would come from any of your argument issues than the relief that comes from 706-1?
As a technical matter, and particularly the ways you all were discussing the complexities of the injunction, the declaratory relief, concretely, we would not get any additional relief from these claims.
And so then the only reason for us to reach it would be to get rid of a district court opinion that's not precedential for anyone anyway?
If you want to really come us,
there's no problem if the district court was right or wrong, really, as long as the relief in this case is no different, because it's not precedent for anyone.
So with respect to due process, of course, the government is the one that raised the objection, so we're responding to their arguments about why they believe the district court was wrong to find due process applied. And yes, we would concede that the Alien Tort statute, you would not have to reach, but to correct what we believe is a fundamental error below, if, of course, you agree with us on 706-1. We want to make clear that concession.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, please.
On the Alien Tort statute, just to put a finer point to the question that's in my mind, is there any case that's actually interpreted the Alien Tort statute and defined what the norms are, the international norms for immigration? Do we have circuit court precedent on that?
Your Honor, we do not have federal circuit court precedent finding that non-refoulement is cognizable under the ATS. I would submit that's not particularly surprising. There's not a wide body of ATS jurisprudence generally, but nevertheless, fundamentally, it is a jurisdictional statute through which Congress has empowered federal courts to identify certain customary international law norms.
Right, but this was the Sosa case, right? Mm-hmm. And which
was unprecedented at the time.
Yeah, and they really reined in the use of the Alien Tort statute. Now, not enough, perhaps, because it's been litigated for the last 23 years, but I would have thought that some of these cases would have come up, but you're telling me there really isn't in the immigration context.
Correct, although the non-refoulement obligation applies and withholding within immigration proceedings. I think these cases are rare, and to the extent that the Supreme Court has reined in the Alien Tort statute, it has not been around the sort of fundamental Sosa question about how to define the norm. It's been around extraterritoriality and whether corporate defendants can be sued. Fundamentally, the question is the norm specific, universal, and obligatory? And really, the dangerous piece of the district court's interpretation was, even after conceding over two pages, that the norm has achieved a jus cogens status, peremptory norm, that nevertheless it was not universal because Australia and, quote, some European countries do not observe the norm and have engaged in turnbacks. And that, I think, betrays the fundamental principle of Filardiga, which is you don't measure the value of the norm by the extent of the breach. and this court's decision in Silverman, which says...
Well, I think I actually agree with you on that point. But where I think my problem is I just don't see how you get through the Sosa gate on the Alien Tort Statute, because I thought they said there were like three areas of law where this case, you know, where you could still go after the Alien Tort Statute, mm-hmm. I mean, bring claims under it. I mean, they said it's largely jurisdictional with
right.
the exception of, you know, like batteries against ambassadors.
Right. Yeah, Your Honor, I think what Sosa said is you can look to comparators of the three kinds of customary international law violations that were recognized in 1789, like piracy and crimes against ambassadors, and ask, today, are the norms as fundamental as they were then? And Sosa was very explicit in saying, not a lovely word, but the ETS is not stillborn. And then asks courts to sit as common law courts. It's an unconventional statute, but the Supreme Court has also been very clear that it does direct federal courts to identify common law.
The Supreme Court expanded beyond those.
Yes, it has.
In what, can you tell me where?
Torture, genocide, war crimes, medical experimentation.
So your position is this reaches that level?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Silverman case tells us to look to a corpus of international law, and there's a consensus, and I don't expect the United States will disagree, that comes from treaties, the Refugee Convention, the 67 Protocol, the Convention Against Torture, that comes from UN statements of practice, including the UNHCR, that comes from state practice. 90 UN members accept the nominal formal obligation, and 125 states have implemented procedures to protect it. It comes from international jurisprudence. The European Court of Human Rights has chastised 5 European countries for engaging in turnbacks. It comes from scholarship. And there is this kind of consensus that's akin to torture. For example, the UN Committee Against Torture has said the norm is as firm as the norm against torture. So it has reached that status. And appreciate your agreement about not measuring at the breach. The other error the district court made was in concluding that the sale case precludes relief here. And we want to be first, the sale is not an ATS case. It simply interpreted a domestic statute and asked if it had extraterritorial effect, and then only engaged with Article 33 of the Refugee Convention and not all of these other sources that we have to look at to identify the norm. And we know sale only dealt with the high seas specifically and not at the border through its statutory interpretation, because it examined whether an executive order that would authorize the interdiction of Haitians outside territorial waters violated the then withholding statute, and said it didn't because the then withholding statute had no extraterritorial effect, unlike we argue, and I know you may disagree, 1158 and 1225 do. And then the Article 33 holding also only really applied to the high seas. It made it very clear in the court's opinion and distinguished between the court is actually very clear that had these Haitians actually arrived to the border, they would have had the protections of international law. But perversely, in my view, the interdiction program had been so successful that it prevented them from reaching the border and therefore invoking those protections which they otherwise been entitled to. So, and then with respect to a due process, I think there are two questions. There's a question of whether or not it applies extraterritorially, and then the scope. On the first question, I think, you know, the government continues to invoke the ghosts of Johnson versus Eisenstrager, which it seems fairly clear to me the Boumediene court firmly rejected and asked not whether or not they're bright-line jurisdictional rules, but the test is not formalism, but practical consequences, and whether applying the Constitution would be impractical and anomalous, and I think the Ninth Circuit is affirming
that. You would agree, if we disagree with your interpretation on the breadth of that case, your case becomes a lot tougher. I mean, if we take the position that due process only applies in the United States, you know, to those who are in the United States, I mean, I guess you're sort of arguing in, you know, your 706-1 argument, but how does do those rise and fall together?
Let me address that, Your Honor. I think as to whether or not the Constitution applies, 10 yards over the United States border, I think absolutely it does if it's not impractical and anomalous. And I think that the Ibrahim Court and the Rodriguez Court have concluded the same, that you would have to apply Houmedi-Anas is impractical and anomalous, and it certainly couldn't be impractical to direct U.S. agents who are, just on this side of the border to apply the Constitution. It wouldn't be anomalous to the extent, as we argue, Congress has imagined that these protections would statutorily apply to people arriving in. Now, your question goes, I think, to the scope of due process. And our position is we concede due process only goes so far as statutory protections for non-resident aliens. And so we are not asking that the due process clause create more rights than the statute does, nor are we even suggesting that if you accept the government's interpretation of 1158, it would create a constitutional question. We do think, though, that is important, the due process question, legally and normatively. Legally, it's potentially important, like non-statutory review, because in a case, someone not have a claim under the APA, say because it's not a final agency action, they should still be able to protect the INA from an independent due process claim. Maybe not relevant here, but for precedential reasons. And then normatively, with respect, Your Honor, we do think it's really important. The government cannot manipulate jurisdictional rules so as to prevent people from actually entering the sphere of statutory protection. That, to me, sounds like the kind of arbitrary executive action that sounds in due process.
Thank you very much, Counsel.
Thank you.
All right, so we've had a lot of argument today. I will give you some rebuttal time. I was going to say 5 minutes. Is that sufficient? You want 10?
I'll take 10.
Oh, you have 10.
You're arguing.
Well, I'm trying to see where he's going to go on this one.
So I'd like to respond, I think, where I can. So I think first, to go to Judge Friedland, your questions. I understand that there are about 600 people who are still in the United States where the transit rule applied to them in expedited removal, whom USCIS is still screening under the district court's injunction. So that's the figure, that's an estimate, right? I don't want to be, precise 600, but it's a substantial number of people. I think the broader point, though, is that for purposes of 1252M1, it doesn't matter whether the proceedings are closed or remained ongoing. What matters is that 1252F1 prohibits injunctions, classified injunctions, that interfere with the way the government is implementing the cover provisions. This is not a collateral effect. Under the four corners of the order, it tells EOIR and DHS to reopen and reconsider closed cases. So this isn't a situation where a court issued an injunction relating to applications of adjustment of status, and then later the government couldn't reinstate removal orders in proceedings. This is a case where the district court targeted its injunction to two immigration judges and asylum officers.
But a collateral effect could affect what immigration judges do. So the issue, if we don't agree with you, you're saying reopening, and it does seem like there could be a question, as I was trying to articulate also with your opposing counsel, about sort of a proceeding that wouldn't happen at all otherwise. But as to just applying certain asylum rules within a proceeding that's happening otherwise, I wouldn't call that reopening. I mean, and so with the 600 people, how many of them are still in a proceeding that would happen otherwise?
These are people who have final orders of expedited removal. That's what that. So those are done. Those are done.
All 600 of them.
That's the figure. Yeah, that's the figure that I'm talking about. Because, I think it's that analytically presents two different questions, but the only one, I think, the only issue that's still live in this case because of the rescission of the transit rule is the retrospective aspect of the court's order that requires reopening and reconsideration. I think to your question...
Maybe I have misunderstood, but I thought that, EOIR has the entire government use the words reopening and reconsideration in the same way in this case as I had thought it wasn't. I thought part of the government was using those words even for ongoing proceedings. And part of it seems like maybe it wasn't.
The reopen or reconsideration came from the second preliminary injunction that the district court issued, right? Because the first preliminary injunction required prohibited prospective applications of the rule. Going forward, it says you may not apply the rule. The second preliminary injunction said that you
we
must...
We were calling the clarification order.
It was a second injunction order, right? Whether we call it a preliminary injunction, it was an order directing the government to do something. It doesn't really matter for the purposes of this appeal anymore because it was all wrapped up in the permanent injunction, which undisputedly this court has jurisdiction over. But the point is the retrospective aspect of the injunction is the only aspect that remains law. And so reopen or reconsider is only referring to cases that are closed, whether the individual is in the United States or is already in the loop. And I want to make the point, too, we provided the master list in April 2021, which was a few short months after this court allowed the district court's injunction to go into effect. So I'm not sure where the three-year figure came from. But in terms of the analytical argument we're raising, the reopen or reconsider order is an order to disturb closed proceedings, which is exactly what 1252F1 prohibits. I think it also argues it also would prohibit the prospective issue, the prospective injunction the district court issued, but the only issue that's actually presented to this court is whether the order to reopen or reconsider closed cases violates 1252F1. And I think to some of the other points about why can't courts just issue rules, class-wide rules about what the asylum laws say, because Congress channeled those into this court through an appropriate PFR or said, in the context of expedited removal, that there is no judicial review. I think that's those are the 1252A2A, that's for expedited removal, and then A5 and B9, that's for removal orders. Next I'd like to perhaps turn to the discussion. I think the entry fishing point that opposing counsel made, that it's just a theory. Right. If the court reads the Sale decision, the court in Sale pointed to the Leng Mei Ma case. And in that case, the withholding statute applied to someone who was physically present in the United States. And the Supreme Court said, physically present doesn't include those who might be here in fact, but not in operation at all. So this isn't a theory. This is something that's actually happened in the past. So maybe, I think the Sale case actually directly supports the rule against surplusage argument that we've... directly rebuts the district court's rule against surplusage theory. I think I'm being neutral.
Am I misunderstanding the government's argument that 1157 applies to those seeking asylum that are outside the United States and 1158 applies if they're inside the United States? Am I misunderstanding that?
No. 1157 is for refugee processing, which isn't just those overseas. It's anyone outside.
And isn't that what the Supreme Court said in Cardoza-Fonseca in 1989?
Yeah.
Okay.
Refugee processing is for those outside the United States. Asylum is for those inside the United States. I think the point about withholding versus delays is exactly right. We think that even if maybe in one individual case the obligation was unlawfully withheld, you can't say on a class-wide basis that that's the case. And that's the fundamental problem.
But you haven't challenged the class certification. So, I don't understand how, if you haven't challenged all the idea that this class is uniform, which you do through a class certification challenge, how you can make that argument now.
So we didn't challenge the class certification decision insofar as the court was seeking to decide the discrete legal question of where the statutes apply. But if the court were to decide, if the lower court had decided that the statute does apply to individuals outside the United States, we would have had to have taken a look then and say, look, this deprives us of the opportunity to raise factual defenses on the arbitrary and capricious claim, because I think exactly as Your Honor pointed out, you can't just say because it's been delayed for one person, or withheld for one person, it's been delayed for everyone, right? The factual record shows that CBP did continue to inspect and process undocumented non-citizens at the ports of entry and refer them for credit cure proceedings. So just because in one case, right, that may not have been lawfully withheld, that doesn't mean it's the case in every other situation. So we're not challenging that on appeal right now because the district court's order didn't reach that issue.
But I assume that you could go back, if there was a ruling favorable to you by the district court on this issue, you then could go back and then challenge class certification at that time.
We could. Yeah, we could.
And that would be based on the new situation. I mean, because these numbers are fluctuating. So theoretically, you go back and challenge it based on the data that was then in existence.
It's not about the numbers; it's about the defenses we raise, Right? Because if the court were to say that the statutes apply to everyone, to apply to non-citizens outside the United States, we would say, all right, we perhaps have good reasons for delaying the discharge of those obligations in some cases. Our defenses aren't border wall, right? They're not one size fits all. One port of entry, I think some of the Texas ports of entry, they had actually cleared the queue. So, I mean, in some ports of entry, there may be good reasons for the delay. Some ports of entry, maybe not. You know, I'm not going to concede that, but that might be what the court would find. But just as an analytical framework, the court couldn't have held that it's arbitrary and capricious for every port all the time, because some ports are experiencing different things at different times.
The whole idea that it's delay. So say I go to the post office with a package tomorrow, and they say, it's the holiday season, we're overwhelmed, we're going to be overwhelmed, come back sometime after Valentine's Day. They don't keep my package, they don't keep my name, there's nothing that says that I'm going to get priority after Valentine's Day. In what sense are they doing anything with my package that it would be delayed?
In that individual case, right, it might be unlawful to pay. But if you had 10,000 people and the post office said, you come back tomorrow, you come back tomorrow, you come back tomorrow, you come back after Valentine's Day, and you're looking at all post offices within, I don't know, a given state, right, any geographic area you want, and they might process your packages at different rates, then in that case you can't say that just because one person's package was, you know, wouldn't be accepted until after Valentine's Day, that everyone else is.
So this is why we have a named plaintiff, and we use their facts, and we talk about whether there are common issues, and whether, like, you have a challenge that all of the class is the same as the named plaintiff. So I was naming a named plaintiff earlier. If that named plaintiff was denied because they were sent away, and you haven't said the other people aren't similar to that person, then I don't understand how you can be saying that now.
We did say that at class certification, but the district court said that it would confine its analysis to discrete questions that were amenable to class-wide resolution, and to its credit, it did. We think, though, it was wrong, and because it was wrong on that, then we should be entitled to present our defenses about whether the delays were reasonable.
But wouldn't you have to have appealed then the class certification or something? I mean, I don't understand how the idea that the class isn't uniform as to this is properly before us at this point.
I see my time has expired. Go ahead and answer your question. It's because the relief that the court issued and the legal determination that the court made is overbroad as to the class, right? So under the four corners of the decision itself, right, just looking at the sole question of is this unlawfully delayed, the court could make that legal determination as to everyone, but it couldn't go ahead then and say the delay is unlawful as to everyone. And it didn't reach that, which is why we didn't appeal.
Well, doesn't it just say the delay is unlawful as to the named plaintiff, and the whole class is the same as the named plaintiff, absent some challenge to that? I mean, maybe you did it, but you didn't challenge it to us. So, like, this idea that the class isn't supposed to be a class, I'm just struggling with how that is something that we can consider now, but we don't have a class certificate.
The court doesn't, I apologize if this is unclear. I'm not asking you all to reconsider the class certification decision. The court should decide the legal issue, right, the statutory interpretation question. If it's in our favor, great, judgment for us on that. If it's not in our favor, we still should be allowed to go back to the district court and say we have individualized defenses. You should reconsider your class certification decision. I have ATS points and due process points, but my time has expired. And I'll respond.
We have your briefing on those points. Do you have any questions about those? All right. Thank you very much, Nelson. All right. I think we've heard plenty today. I think we're good. I want to first thank the lawyers and counsel and all people who worked on this case. I appreciate the pro bono efforts. This is a lot of work. Thank you for making the trip out. I also want to thank our court security officers. Thanks for literally standing by for a long period of time. It'll be hard on the lower back to be standing that long. So I appreciate you very much doing that. And I want to thank our court staff from Pasadena for making the trip and making this all possible. Thank you for sitting through those who made it through the whole time. Appreciate it. This case is submitted, and this special session in San Diego is adjourned. Thank you.
All right. This court for this session stands adjourned.